Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. China's most famous human rights activist, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Liu Xiaobo, spent years in prison for his political convictions and died in state custody last week. You didn't hear much from President Trump about Liu's passing or human rights in general. This hour on Point, the Trump administration and human rights. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you want your president to raise the torch for human rights? Is America first enough? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today via Skype from Beijing is Chris Buckley, China correspondent for The New York Times. You can link to his latest reporting on this story at our website, onpointradio.org. Chris Buckley, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
It is the rare political activist dissident who becomes a Nobel Peace Prize winner. Can you please give us the history of Liu Xiaobo and why he rose to such prominence in China?
Well, Liu Xiaobo is, was a human rights activist who emerged from China in the 1980s when there was a great deal of intellectual and political ferment in China. And then when he was a young academic, he threw himself in support of the student protests that took over Tiananmen Square in 1989. And he remained on the square until the very end. He was imprisoned subsequently, and that whole experience set him on a path of a life of political dissidence that he kept on through several periods of imprisonment and labor camps right up until the very end, until his passing away last week. And I think why he was important to many Chinese people within the human rights and dissident community was because of his depth of experience. And he had the kind of background and experience where he was able to deal comfortably with, for example, former officials and academics, but also people on the more, you could say, radical fringe of China's human rights movement as well. So in that sense, he was somebody who managed to unify people or bring people together in a way that other dissidents perhaps weren't so able to do.
I'm reading here that he's the first Nobel Peace Prize winner to die in state custody since 1938, when the German pacifist, this is Karl von Ossietzky, died after years in Nazi Germany's concentration camps. How much of his life did Liu Xiaobo spend in prison, in labor camp, and what was his status at the end when he was suffering from cancer? Where was he? How was he held?
Oh, geez, sorry, Tom. I haven't actually counted how many years he spent in prison and custody altogether, but it was 21 months after 1989, and there were other stints in the 1990s. And then, of course, he was convicted on the final charge of inciting subversion of state power in 2009. And so he had been in prison from then up until his death last week. And then he received the Nobel Peace Prize, of course, 1 year after he'd been imprisoned in 2009.
And when he died, what was his status, Chris? Where was he?
Well, officially he'd been granted medical parole. But if medical parole suggests to you that he had some sort of freedom about where he could get his medical treatment, then obviously that wasn't the case. Although he was allowed to go to a hospital in northeast China to receive treatment for his terminal liver cancer, he was still under heavy guard. Only his close family were allowed to be near him or visit him. Other people who wanted to visit him weren't allowed to visit him. And two foreign doctors, an American and a German, were allowed to see him. They said that he and his wife had requested that he be allowed to travel abroad for medical treatment, and he wasn't allowed to travel either. So in the very end, he had a kind of freedom in that he was outside of prison, but he certainly wasn't outside of confinement.
What about the status of his wife? You mentioned her, Lu Xia. Was she under house arrest?
She has been under house arrest and heavy surveillance since 2010, when Liu Xiaobo won the Nobel Peace Prize. And so she's been living in an apartment in Beijing, but under heavy guard, oppressive guard. And I think it's been psychologically, spiritually very difficult for her to cope. Since her husband died, the government has released pictures showing her attendance at his funeral and also when his ashes were lowered into the sea. But she hasn't been able to contact, at least as far as I know, anybody outside a close circle of friends. And so it's even unclear where she is at this point.
Can you speak to how the Chinese government handled the physical remains of Liu Xiaobo and the significance of that handling and how it is or is not within the norm of Chinese burial or ceremony?
Well, he was buried at sea. So he was cremated in a ceremony early on Sunday morning, if I remember my days correctly. Mm-hmm. And then later in the day, his ashes were transported about 100 miles to the coast. I'm guessing about 100 miles, taken on board a boat, and then they were lowered in a container and gently lowered into the sea, as chrysanthemum petals, a symbol of mourning in China, were also scattered onto the sea.
But this is unusual in Chinese culture, in Chinese tradition. This is not the normal way.
This is very unusual. The Chinese government said it was part of a tradition. It's not a widespread tradition in China. His older brother, who is a former official, also came forward and said he supported the idea of a sea burial. But the fact is, I think that the reason why this particular form of disposing of his ashes was chosen was because there would then be no grave site or memorial site on land that could serve as a magnet for protest or a symbol of Liu Xiaobo's continuing presence, even in the afterlife in China.
How widely known and remembered is Liu Xiaobo? And what about the Chinese government's crackdown on social media discussion of him in the wake of his death?
That's a good question, Tom. On the one hand, I think if you ask many young people in China who is Liu Xiaobo, most people wouldn't know. If they did know, they might have a very obscure, faint impression of somebody who was jailed or who was a big name in 1989, but not be able to put any substance to it. But I think among a more narrow group of people who do care about human rights or are curious about news from the outside world, he and his death were significant news. And if you looked on social media during his final illness and after his death, certainly there was a lot of censorship, but I was also struck by the amount of comment on his death that it was also managed to seep onto the internet. So symbols of an empty chair, for example, just as the chair was left empty for his a Nobel Peace Prize ceremony in 2010 because he couldn't attend, or of veiled references to his name. People couldn't spell out his name in full, but they might refer, for example, to the passing of Brother Liu or something like that. And the fact that people are passing around these messages suggested to me that censorship can create ignorance about somebody like Liu Xiaobo, but it can also create a great deal of curiosity about who is this person who we're not allowed to talk about. And I think there was some of that reaction in China as well, that people who perhaps hadn't been paying attention then became curious, like, about who he was and why he'd been in prison and why he died in custody.
Hard, difficult to even know about the man, potentially, in a system where discussion of Tiananmen and Liu Xiaobo get a lot of resistance from the government. The White House had put out a statement saying that President Trump was deeply saddened by news of Liu's death. Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, said in his fight for freedom, equality, and constitutional rule in China, Liu Xiaobo embodied the human spirit that the Nobel Prize rewards. But on the same day of his death, we had President Trump talking about the Chinese leader Xi Jinping, who has, by most accounts, been rather more authoritarian than even the norm for China. And the American president talking about Xi Jinping, saying, I have great respect for him, calling him a great leader. This is on the day of Liu Xiaobo's death. A great leader, a very talented man, a very good man. He loves China, Trump said. He wants to do what's right for China. This is hardly a cold shoulder to China on the day of the Nobel Peace Prize winner's death.
That's true. It seems to be a little bit of inconsistent messaging there. And I think if you speak to dissidents in China or people working on human rights in China, I think one message that people always tell you is that what's important in talking to China on these issues is consistency. So, of course, it's important to talk about China about a whole range of issues, and that will include trade and North Korea and many other things. But insofar as you want to talk to China about human rights, I think people think that dealing with China with this issue in a consistent way is very important, so that it's understood by the Chinese leadership that this is an issue that's brought out at certain times and then put back on the shelf.
Chris, at this point, with all of China's economic success, still expanding success, does China give a whit about what the U.S., about what the West think about its, what we call human rights issues?
I think when it comes to the human rights message from the United States and its impact on China, I think it's still multifaceted. On the one hand, China is much stronger than before, much more confident than before. The government is much less patient in dealing with pressure from the United States and Western governments on human rights, and that seems clear. So, for example, up until 2005, we do have examples of prisoners, Chinese prisoners in similar circumstances to Liu Xiaobo, with medical illnesses, who were given medical parole and then allowed to travel to the West. But we haven't seen cases like that since 2005, and that suggests a shift. On the other hand, if you look at how the Chinese government has dealt with the passing of Liu Xiaobo, putting out a great deal of its own propaganda and videos and commentaries for foreign audiences about Liu Xiaobo and about how they're handling his audience, that suggests that they are still sensitive about how they're perceived in the West and how in particular they were perceived in the handling of Liu Xiaobo's death.
Chris Buckley with the New York Times there. We're right up against the clock here. We're so grateful to you for joining us from Beijing today, and I want to thank you very much for that. We're going to go on and look at America's stand on human rights in the Trump era. Join us. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's stand on human rights in the Trump era, in the wake of the death of Chinese dissident and Nobel Peace Prize winner Liu Xiaobo last week. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Is America a beacon for freedom, democracy, human rights in the age of Donald Trump? Do you want Washington to hold the flag for human dignity, human rights? What do you make of Washington's low-key response to China's long imprisonment and now death of Nobel Prize winner Liu Xiaobo? I guess there's more to look at as well on that front in the Trump years. It's not as though the U.S. has had a sterling record on human rights itself, but there has been a long tradition of holding a kind of torch, a kind of flame high. Here was President John F. Kennedy. This is his historic 1961 inaugural address in the very heart of the Cold War, telling his countrymen, Americans, the United States would do whatever it took to pursue the cause of freedom around the world.
Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
John F. Kennedy, Inauguration Day, 1961. Flash forward, 2017, and here was the inauguration day of President Donald Trump.
From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
Donald Trump's view of the world right there. With us right now from Washington, Sarah Margon. She's Washington Director at Human Rights Watch. Sarah, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, happy to be here.
So America has its own dappled history here, but a long tradition of American presidents for a long time now speaking up pretty clearly about human rights. What can we learn from what we've just seen in the death of Nobel Peace Prize winner Liu Xiaobo?
You know, you raise an important point. There's always been a tension between national security and basic rights for all presidents, all administrations. But what we're seeing from President Trump is really quite different. It's a radical departure from the norm. It's upsetting and disrupting the critical role the United States has played in supporting and advancing, promoting basic human rights. What President Trump did on the heels of Liu Xiaobo's death is really remarkable. Because it wasn't for lack of statements from other officials. The working level at the White House has really been putting a lot of time into getting the right message out. But making the commentary that he did on President Xi really just undermined anything else that the U.S. could have said from the executive branch. And that's not the first time we've seen things like that from him.
Put it in a broader context. President Trump has been quite effusive in his praise for any number of autocrats who don't put human rights, to put it mildly, front and center. I mean, you can look at, of course, Vladimir Putin. You can go to Erdogan in Turkey. You can go to Duterte in the Philippines and right on round. What do you see there?
I think that's right. I mean, you've seen a number of you've seen a number of autocrats who have been headed to the White House for meetings. And it's not unusual for the president or senior U.S. government officials to meet very difficult or repressive individuals, leaders specifically. But what is different is there's no public commentary or press conference where there's an opportunity to either express concern from the U.S. side about what's happening in countries. We saw this very specifically with Egyptian President Sisi. There's no open press conference where journalists are really allowed to ask questions from either side, whether in that case Egyptian or United States. And so what this does is it creates a narrative, it creates a vision that really enables and emboldens autocratic leaders, repressive leaders, to keep doing what they're doing. Because even if things are being said in private, nobody else knows about it. And if there's no change in behavior from those leaders, basically the U.S. seems to be or will be seen as endorsing the actions of those leaders. And so it's not just from the government side of things, it's also from the defenders, the activists, the champions of free press and accountability in any number of countries around the world. Well, this becomes a problem. Because
are you suggesting with that, forgive me, sir, but are you suggesting with that that you have reason to believe that in private the Trump administration is ardently pushing a human rights agenda?
No, they have said they won't raise things publicly, but that they will do it privately. But we have no idea if that's actually happening. And that's part of the problem. Using the media, using external actors, civil society, having meetings with civil society activists before or around a meeting with a high-level foreign official is a tried and true tactic of many administrations to show that there is balance in the U.S. policy. And that it's not just about the rhetorical comments, but it's also about the conduct of the U.S. government,
you don't have
and
to go
particularly
back,
the president.
You don't have to go back to 1961. I mean, just remember, this is historic, but this was June 1987, and this was President Ronald Reagan gave a speech at the Brandenburg Gate in West Berlin next to the old Berlin Wall when it still stood. And he famously called on then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev to open Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union up to the West in the name of freedom and peace. Here was Ronald Reagan.
If you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
U.S. President Ronald Reagan, that is about as public as you can get. After the death of Liu Xiaobo last week, we had a statement acknowledging that from the Secretary of State. and the White House. But just hours later, President Trump was asked in a press conference in Paris what he thinks of China's pretty tough line, President Xi Jinping. Here was how the U.S. president handled the question on the day of Liu Xiaobo's death.
Well, he's a friend of mine. I have great respect for him. We've gotten to know each other very well. A great leader. He's a very talented man. I think he's a very good man. He loves China, I can tell you. He loves China. He wants to do what's right for China.
Talking about the Chinese leader there on the day of the death of the Nobel Peace Prize winner Liu Xiaobo. And here was Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. This was talking with State Department employees about the relationship between American values and national security interests. It's kind of a hold your horses message.
You condition our national security efforts on someone adopting our values, we probably can't achieve our national security goals or our national security interest. If we condition too heavily that others must adopt this value that we've come to over a long history of our own, it really creates obstacles to our ability to advance our national security interest, our economic interest. It doesn't mean that we leave those values on the sidelines.
Doesn't mean the values are left on the sidelines, but there's been a lot less talk about them and a lot more pretty warm engagement with autocrats under the Trump administration. Sarah Margon is with us, Washington Director at Human Rights Watch. With us as well right now from Washington is Mike Gonzalez, Senior Fellow at the Davis Institute for National Security, Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. He was a speechwriter in the George W. Bush administration at the State Department. Mike Gonzalez, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Do you see the Trump administration leaving those American values, liberty, freedom, human rights, on the sidelines in the Trump administration? Or is there something going on here that we should pay attention to may not be so obvious?
Well, I am one who does believe that human rights should be part of the mix of our foreign policy. I think they should. They're very important for many, many reasons, including the America First national security interest. But I would say that it's way too early to say that this is a radical departure from American norms, because we're only not even 6 months in. Now, on Liu Xiaobo's death.
Could we just pause right there for a second? Just 6 months, that's true. But you, like the rest of us, have heard and seen President Trump's rather warm embrace of pretty straight-up autocrats with a lot of people in prison.
Right. Let me address that right now on the issue of Liu Xiaobo's death. I think you got the order wrong.
Okay.
I think he was asked in Paris very early in the morning at the press conference, early in the morning for us, about Xi Jinping. I am not even sure that he had been informed of Liu Xiaobo's death. He was dealing with the visit to Paris. He said that at a press conference, which came around, I think, around 7 a.m. our time, or maybe 8 a.m. our time. Liu Xiaobo had died a few hours earlier. Then much later on, I think I have the order right, Secretary Tillerson issued a statement which, though I would have gone much further, was actually not bad. It was a bad statement, calling for Liu's widow, Mrs. Xia, to be released. So that was not a bad thing. Now, would I want the Trump administration to go further in pushing human rights in China? Yes. And I think very quickly, if you look at the issues that concern the Trump administration, which is North Korea, for example, or our trade deficit, they're both really intricately tied to the fact that China is run by a totalitarian regime. You know, one of the reasons why Chinese labor is so low is that they have no collective bargaining. And one of the reasons why they, even though party-to-party relationships with Pyongyang are not that great, but they do have some sympathy for the anti-democratic, norms of North Korea. So really, their human rights behavior should be part of the mix. But let's not get too carried away here on this issue.
Sarah, is it too soon to judge the Trump administration on its human rights stance, given what we have heard in the 6 months we've already seen?
I mean, there's certainly no final decisions being made, but I think everything we've seen is certainly a departure from the norm in a pretty serious sense. We've seen the U.S., the White House and the president in particular sort of try to walk the United States back from its global leadership role. We've seen major slashes to the foreign aid budget. We've seen a significant uptick in civilian casualties around the world. We've seen attacks against the press. We've seen autocratic meetings in the White House and a rather remarkable attempt to move towards autocracy by the president himself. Luckily, he's been stopped by domestic U.S. institutions. We're seeing a lot of inconsistencies. We're not seeing any clear sense of what they believe American or universal values are. I think there's still time to turn the ship around, so to speak. But I would say we're at a point right now that's pretty critical. And if you look at the messages coming from the media, if you look at the American activism, if you look at the response from global leaders and the U.S. Congress, I think everyone is pretty clear on both sides of the aisle that this is not how the U.S. has done business in the past when it comes to human rights.
I mean, to be
fair, Tom, if I may.
Yes, Mike?
If I very quickly, I think that we should look at the whole globe. I think on Cuba, for example, on Venezuela and on Syria, you must give President Trump, you know, pretty good marks. In Venezuela, even liberals will tell you that they would give him an A because every time he talks to a Latin American leader, he brings up Nicolas Maduro, the Constituent Assembly, what is going on down there. On Cuba, he's done the right thing. And on Syria—
You say he's done the right thing in reeling back some of the Obama-era liberalizations. Why do you say the right thing in terms of human rights, Mike?
In terms of the fact that the human right campaigners and the dissidents in Cuba, you know, the top six or eight really welcomed what Trump did and were dismayed by what Obama did. But let me quickly move to Syria. Dale, let's not forget that he hit this, you know, Syrians with Tomahawk missiles after they used poison gas on their own people.
Well,
again, Obama.
I mean, but there was a lot of sort of after talk about what the damage really was there and how significant that was. It was a lot of expensive Tomahawk missiles.
It was a lot more than what Obama did.
I think the other question, if I might here, I think your point, Mike, is important that you have seen a few signs of some willingness to engage, but they're geopolitically safe for him to do so. You're right. We did see engagement on Syria. Human Rights Watch takes no position on military intervention. And the language that he used around that time was impressive. He talked about protection and accountability. But we have seen very, very little going forward. And even though there is quite, you know, a to-do here in Washington about Russia's role around the election, we still see the United States looking for ways to engage with Russia on Syria militarily. And that's very concerning given the role that Russia has played in Syria when it comes to the military.
What about Mike Gonzalez's point on President Obama and his time? I mean, it's not as though Liu Xiaobo, the great Nobel Peace Prize winner in China, was released under President Obama's watch.
I mean, a lot of the criticism, you know, that we have made on human rights issues is not reserved for one party or the other. We were very vocal when it came to Syria, when it came to China with the previous administration, talking about how we wanted to see these issues raised to a much higher level. In the case of Syria, it was quite disappointing in the end to see how unable the administration was to engage on protection, given the sheer numbers of civilians that were being killed and the number of refugees that are coming out of Syria. But I wouldn't say when it comes coming back to Trump, I wouldn't say that we're seeing a productive or a positive Syria policy, particularly if he really cares about Syria so much, then he could do a better job of letting Syrian refugees into this country.
Well, Mike Gonzalez, what about the U.S. as a, at least in its self-image, as a torchbearer, and I think beyond that, for human rights and the kind of city on a hill, as Ronald Reagan would have put it? We heard President Trump, this was back in February, and Bill O'Reilly trying to get President Trump to say something critical about the policies and record of Vladimir Putin. And this was what O'Reilly got from President Trump for an answer.
He's a killer, though. Putin's a killer.
A lot of killers. You got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent?
What do you think of that sort of moral equivalency from an American president who we associate with standing at least symbolically for human rights, liberty, freedom, and the city on the hill, Mike?
Yeah, no, definitely. That's where I would give President Trump the lowest mark right now is in the rhetoric he uses towards Putin himself. The way he doesn't call Putin a killer, a thug, a kleptocrat, and that is actually that is obviously needed. On the other hand, you do see some strong actions. Not only were there no concessions at the G20 meetings, but existing sanctions against Russia were strengthened by the U.S. Treasury. You know, the Senate is playing a role in that as well. And I have to go back to this the action in Syria. This did not please Putin because, you know, Putin is an ally of Assad. So, and again, let me bring up the case of Venezuela because it's a very stark case. President Trump has had Leopoldo López, that's the jail dissident, the political leader. He's had his wife to the White House, something that didn't happen under Obama. He has mentioned him by name, defended him. President Obama just could not bring himself to do any of this. And John Kerry, if anything, was trying to figure out a way to have a dialogue with Maduro through Tom Shannon. So, you know, if you look at the whole world as a chess set, you see some good sides, you see some bad sides. Obviously, that you know, that what you just played there with that kind of a
O'Reilly.
Moral equivalence, yeah, with O'Reilly, that's not something I would support, and I think that's a low point. But if you look at his actions with Russia so far, 6 months in, not even, you know, pretty good. No concessions.
Okay. But
if I could just add one thing here on Russia, I think what's really important is part of the reason we've seen this change is because of the role of Congress. Congress has come together in a very strong bipartisan manner on Russia, and that has really boxed in the administration on its Russia position.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's stand on human rights in the era of the presidency of Donald Trump, in the wake of the death of Chinese dissident and Nobel Peace Prize winner Liu Xiaobo. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Does America first mean human rights take a back seat? Should Donald Trump have been out there hammering Beijing to let Liu Xiaobo get treatment for his cancer abroad before his death? And will championing human rights come to look like a late 20th century fluke eventually? A passing fad, does it? Already. At a White House briefing in May, Press Secretary Sean Spicer said that building relationships with autocratic leaders like the Philippines' Rodrigo Duterte or Egypt's Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is a necessary part of diplomacy, even if the United States doesn't agree with those countries on human rights issues. Here's Spicer.
The reason that the president is building an effective coalition is getting results around the globe and reasserting America's place is because he understands the type of diplomacy and the type of negotiating and the type of deal making that actually gets real results for our country. So I think it's not a balancing, it's a balancing act, but the president's getting real results.
Critics in both parties, though, sometimes here was a John McCain, Arizona senator, criticizing the president for praising North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in an interview with MSNBC's Morning Joe back in May.
I don't understand it, and I don't think that the president appreciates the fact that when he says things like that, it helps the credibility and the prestige of this really outrageous strongman. You know, the largest gulag left on Earth is in North Korea, and we all know about their human rights abuses.
There's a different tone, to say the very least, and different kinds of commentary on autocratic leaders lately, Vladimir Putin right at the front of the line. Sarah Margon is with us from Human Rights Watch, Mike Gonzalez from the Heritage Foundation. With us right now from Washington is Sarah Snyder. She's professor of history at American University, specializes in the U.S. human rights policy history, author of the forthcoming From Selma to Moscow, How Human Rights Activists Transformed U.S. Foreign Policy. Sarah Snyder, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Put the Trump administration's tone and substance, if you would, on human rights in historical context for us. How's it look, Sarah?
It's really a very meaningful shift. I think that we certainly would have expected, given the rhetoric that came out of the campaign, for the Trump administration to shift its approach on human rights. We might have expected to have seen differences in tactics, different attention to or attention to different types of rights. Say, we might have expected them to privilege attention to concerns about religious discrimination, and we also might have expected them to shift the geographic focus. But to entirely push aside the project of attention to human rights, I think was quite surprising to those of us who've followed this issue for some time.
Justify that characterization, entirely push aside the project of human rights. Where and how do you see that in the Trump administration?
Well, I think Tillerson's remarks to State Department employees on May 3rd were quite clear. I mean, I would say that he created outlined a false choice that we have to choose between championing values and protecting national security or economic interests. But that's certainly the rhetoric that he's using. You know, he says it creates obstacles to our ability to advance our national security interests, our economic interests. He says that You know, these are our values that we shouldn't be imposing and pushing upon other people, whereas really these are values that have been internationally agreed since the late 1940s and have repeatedly been expanded and reaffirmed. This isn't an American imposed project. This is something the international community has decided is important.
So in the Trump administration's, is it simply an absence of criticism or jawboning, or do you see the president's actual comments as turning the country's policy in a different direction? Sarah?
I think for me, looking at the Secretary of State's comments are a bit more significant than looking at what Trump is saying. I think thus far he's shown himself to be a bit mercurial, and I'm not sure that we should see every tweet as really a clear articulation of U.S. policy. But Tillerson's speech was, I think, clearly thought out. And he talked about values and the extent to which the United States was going to downgrade attention to human rights in a number of ways. And so I think that's what's most concerning. I do think, to your earlier question about timing, you know, is it too soon to really evaluate the Trump administration's approach? I think that's true. Early on in the Reagan administration, his Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, made a speech saying that the United States was going to downgrade attention to human rights and focus on international terrorism instead. And we saw a bipartisan congressional effort that was supported by NGOs such as Helsinki Watch, the precursor to Human Rights Watch, as well as members of the public who really pushed back on the Reagan administration. And I would argue that the Reagan administration, at least in some instances, particularly looking at the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, therefore had a very robust approach to human rights, which wasn't signaled in the early months of his administration. So I think it's still possible that we could have a shift. But Tillerson's remarks are not encouraging for any of those who are looking for evidence that this will be an administration that cares about human rights.
Professor Snyder, is it possible that we will look back on the last 40, 50 years, I mean, go all the way back to JFK's Bernie Burden speech, and American presidents talking about human rights, championing human rights, saying, well, yes, that was a luxury of a time when the United States was economically and politically, geopolitically super powerful in the world and in the Cold War, where it was advantageous for American presidents to speak this way. And we could look back on that as a finite window of time. The closes. The American presidents just stop doing that when China becomes rich and powerful, and they feel they may pay a price for a greater price for standing up for human rights.
I don't think so. The first reason is that American support for human rights is very popular within the country. As recently as 2015, 77% of Americans polled said that they wanted the United States to be the world's leader in promoting human rights. If we go back to 1776 with the Declaration of Independence, we can see very early instances in which Americans are talking about their rights and those of others. I mean, championing human rights has become to be seen as really integral to the character of being American. And finally, championing human rights advances American security. It helps reduce anti-Americanism. It helps create a stable world that makes and reliable allies that adds to American security. So I don't think that we're going to see this as a sort of, I think what will be a blip is the Trump administration's approach. And also this is because attention to human rights has really become institutionalized in U.S. foreign policy. We have, since 1977, a bureau within the State Department that's tasked with paying attention to human rights. We have congressionally mandated annual reports that assess the human rights records of foreign countries. We have limits on the extent to which the United States can give security and economic assistance to governments that abuse human rights. And so I don't think that we're going to see this as just the product of a sort of unipolar United States at the tail end of the Cold War. And I would say that this also isn't an American project. This is something for which there's broad-based international support. And so I don't think that we're going to see this as just a moment of the late or early post-Cold War years.
True, broad-based, no doubt. But as China becomes a bigger and bigger and richer part of that global picture, one wonders. Sarah Snyder, please stand by there in Washington. Mike Gonzalez, Sarah Margon, lots of callers for the three of you. Auburn, Alabama, Scott's calling. Hi, Scott, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I find this conversation to be a little bit humorous and sort of telling about the election. I'm no fan of Trump's by any stretch, but I've gotten used to the somber in the age of Trump stories that have given The Atlantic and The New York Times and you guys very, very high ratings, the somber in the age of Trump. But I just don't understand why people think that we were doing significantly well in any previous time. I look at, gosh, going back from Rwanda, going to Syria, to the fecklessness at which the Arab Spring was handled, to Venezuela, to having an airplane shot down by its first air missile in Europe and nothing done about it, the North Koreans starving their own people as we try to get them to prevent them from making nuclear weapons. Mm. It seems that there's a sense that talking and saying appropriate things, the left is so concerned about language. If we just got the language right, I see no place other than Reagan and maybe a few others where this was coupled with anything. So none of these issues you guys discussed today happened on Trump's watch. And so the idea that Rex Tillerson yesterday, I thought he actually, it made a pretty good sense what he said, but this idea that this is worth the whole show, that there's been some new in the age of Trump with a somber tone.
Scott, you're way more sardonic than I would go. I'm not accustomed to American presidents speaking in such glowing terms about autocrats, and so regularly. That is new to my ear, and I'm also not accustomed to American presidents' moral relativism about the U.S. Now, you may call that realism, but to me, that sounds like something. Well, quite new, but let me pick it up with our historian here. I mean, Sarah Snyder, is this too much beard stroking here about the Trump human rights posture and language, as Scott says?
I think rhetoric matters a lot. It signals not only to foreign leaders what our priorities are, but as Sarah Morgan was saying earlier, it gives comfort and inspires activists around the world who are fighting often in very difficult and dangerous conditions for their rights. And I also think that to suggest that just because previous U.S. presidents have not always been consistent in their advancing of human rights, that we shouldn't somehow be concerned about the rhetoric that's coming out of the State Department and the White House strikes me as really a very weak excuse of the current administration.
Mike Gonzalez, can a president talk up autocrats and hold a torch for liberty, human rights?
Tom, I do agree with Scott. First of all, it was FDR who said of Anastasio Somoza, he is an SOB, but he's our SOB. And it was, again, FDR who really cozied up to Stalin and just could not bring himself to say anything bad about Stalin. So while I think Dr. Snyder makes a very good point, that our support for freedom and democracy really goes back to 1776. It was reemphasized by John Quincy Adams, by Abraham Lincoln, by McKinley, by many presidents. It's not something that started with JFK by any means. I don't think.
But isn't it different to say he's an SOB, but he's our SOB? Isn't that a little different than saying he's an awesome dude? He's an awesome guy, this autocrat, this killer, as Bill O'Reilly said of Putin.
And again, as I said, I'm not going to defend that statement. That is not a statement that I think should have been made. At the same time, if you look at the actions with Russia, as I said, the sanctions were strengthened by the U.S. Treasury ahead of the meeting. No concessions were made. We lobbed Tomahawk missiles at their allies in Syria. President Trump brought up Ukraine several times. So I think that Scott makes a very good point. This is look at actions. And this look at actions around the world. Venezuela, again, what we have done there is that with Cuba, President Obama, let's not forget, the first international foreign policy act of the Obama administration is to refuse to support the Green Revolution in Iran. We know because of the investigative reporting that the Wall Street Journal has done that Obama not only could not bring himself to support the people protesting Ahmadinejad, but he pulled back expenditures by the CIA in supporting those people. He stopped them. So Obama was
real
not
real politique right there.
Tom,
yeah.
Tom, yeah. Tom, yes. Tom, Obama maybe was not, I can
Sorry, I just want to give you, I think the rhetoric question is incredibly important, but I also, and I do think the rhetoric matters, but it's conduct as well. And if you look at, let me give you three quick examples of where we're seeing conduct move in the wrong direction. The first is on civilian casualties, which I mentioned earlier. We're seeing significant uptick in civilian casualties in Iraq, in Syria, and in Afghanistan because of U.S. and coalition-related operations. And it's not entirely clear why that's happening, but it's likely a lack of accelerated options and a lack of clear understanding of who's on the ground where.
So that's not a matter of criticizing others. That's American action leading to those.
That is American and coalition. And the problem there is that the investigations are really opaque, and there has been very little compensation or what they're called ex gratias payments for the victims and the victims' families. That's one. The second one is the uptick in arms sales. There are three countries that are seeing arms sales, all three of which were slowed down by the previous administration because of human rights concerns. Saudi Arabia, which has gone through, which is waging a horrific war in Yemen, and the U.S. just, Congress just tried to push back against the sale of precision-guided munitions because those are the weapons being used by the Saudi coalition that are killing thousands and thousands of civilian, Yemeni civilians. But we're also looking at upcoming sales to Bahrain and Nigeria, both of which were slowed by the last administration and are restarted without any change on the ground from those governments. And the third is the reinstitution of the Mexico City policy or the global gag rule, which usually gets put back in place by Republican administrations.
This is on family planning.
That's right. It requires NGOs who receive U.S. foreign aid to certify that they won't use their own non-U.S. government funds to provide abortion services or counsel patients about the option of abortions or advocate for the liberalization of those laws. Now, this is a hot-button issue in Washington, but what is so dramatic about what the Trump administration has done is that the impact of their rules and regulations will be 15 times more expansive than previous Republican administration rules. More people, men, women, and children will die as a result of this.
I mean,
that
you put that
problematic.
In the human rights category. Are you ready to make the judgment now? Mike Gonzalez says it's only 6 months. Wait.
I disagree with what Sarah just said about the Mexico City rules. I think that we...
But the numbers are there to show. It's 15 times... $8.8 billion is going to be impacted as opposed to under...
Well, Sarah, money is fungible. Money is fungible, which is the reason why they did it this way. Let's go back again to what is happening, the things that are being done.
That list, but I want to ask
first,
Sarah Marga.
The first 9 months of the Bush presidency were nothing like the last 7 years of the Bush presidency. Things change a lot, and I'm not sure that things need to change right now either.
Sarah Marga, too soon to judge?
I think we can judge and hope that things move in a much better direction.
Sarah Snyder, you've got the arc of history in your sights. Too soon to judge?
It is, as Mike suggested, very early in this term, but I think that we shouldn't be complacent in making sure that members of Congress, NGOs like Human Rights Watch, and members of the public who are concerned make their issues known so that we can try and turn this around.
An eye on human rights as Nobel Peace Prize winner and Chinese political dissident Liu Xiaobo meets his end in state custody. First Nobel Peace Prize winner to do so since Nazi Germany in 1938. Sarah Snyder at American University, thank you very much for being with us. Mike Gonzalez at the Heritage Foundation and Sarah Margon at Human Rights Watch. Our thanks to all three of you for joining us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.